Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231. It's October 24th, Wednesday. And we're going to finish up central nervous system, move on to peripheral nervous system. So when I say central nervous system, what should you be thinking of? Brain and spinal cord. Yeah, don't forget that spinal cord. We still have to finish up spinal cord today. So let's look at the schedule. Slide on the right over here. I'm going to turn maybe a couple of these lights off. Like so. All right, so today we said was the 24th, indeed it is, and we're going to have some lab practicums on the 5th and the 7th. We're not changing that, and the exam, lecture exam, will be the week after that. Don't forget we have a holiday on a Monday, Veterans Day, the 12th. All right, so you can study up for that exam coming. All right, but let's pay attention to lab practicum number 3, because I'm going to change the schedule on you guys, because according to the lab manual, we're supposed to start doing a heart dissection next week, all right, which is lab number 9. And I'm going to put off lab number 9 until when we start talking about the heart in lecture. So we're going to go to lab number 10 next week. So what I have on the board, I guess I got to turn the lights back on. What I have on the board is a new schedule, but I'll email that out to everybody. All right, so next week, we're not going to do lab number 9, we're going to do lab number 10. And lab number 10 is a cow eye dissection and brain model. That will be on the third practicum, not the heart. So I know it kind of messes up the schedule a little bit. So October 29th and 31st, cow eye dissection and brain model, that's going to be on the practicum, which is going to be on November 5th and 7th, which is the week after that. All right, then after the practicum, we're going to do lab number 11, which is some more brain stuff and senses, and then we're going to do lab number 9, the heart, and that will correspond better with lecture, okay? And so the heart will not be on practicum 3, it's going to be on the last practicum. We'll see how that works. So what else do we want to look at in here? Since we're doing a dissection next time, I want to make sure that everybody's prepared to do those dissections, eyeballs, brains, fetal pig are in a preserving solution, which could be sort of dangerous. Certainly is if you drink it, but I don't think anybody would really want to drink it. But nonetheless, we still need eye protection and hand protection. We want to protect our eyes from that preserving fluid because we don't want to turn our corneas into plastic. And that's what that preserving fluid does. It just plasticizes biological tissue so it can't rot. And, of course, then you don't want any on your hands, so your hands are pretty tough, could probably handle it, but still hand protection is required. So here on the syllabus it says buy a box of nitrile or latex exam gloves for next week, and then we're going to be using them probably every week thereafter in lab. That's why maybe just buying a box of something would be good. If you're allergic to latex, which is a protein, get the nitrile gloves. Do not get the polypropylene gloves, which are the food service handling gloves. They're way too leaky. They don't really protect your hands. Those are just a clear plastic gloves. And then you need safety glasses. You can use your goggles that you use in chemistry lab. That's kind of overkill. But any kind of safety glasses that fit over your eyes or fit over your regular glasses is good. But here is a reference for the fluid shield. Or it's a visor procedure mask. It contains a mask that goes over your mouth as well as a plastic visor that protects your eyes. So that's really handy, and when you're not using it, you can fold it flat and put it in a book and carry it around easier than you can a pair of safety glasses. All right, so those are the things that are mandatory, hand protection, eye protection, and a mask for your mouth is not mandatory, but it's kind of handy because sometimes when you're doing a dissection, like when you jab into the eyeball, this big squirt of eyeball juice might come out, and if you're talking at the same time, then it's going to squirt in your mouth, but if you're wearing a mask, that kind of protects you. Or if you're dissecting the meninges off the brain and it flicks up into the air, if you're talking, it can flick some, you know, preserved brain or meninges into your mouth. So a mask is kind of handy to have, especially if you talk when you're dissecting, like, which is typically what I have to do. A blunt probe, dissection scissors, and scalpel, you don't necessarily need to bring. These are optional, but if you have a sharp pair of scissors at home and a sharp scalpel that you have or maybe you're using at work, bring it into lab. It'll be better than the instruments that we have. All right, so that's it for lab next time. Not a heart dissection, but an eyeball dissection and models of the brain And that's what will be on the practicum the week after, not the heart. I'll send an email out. If you have any questions, make sure you talk to me. All right, so we were talking about central nervous system last time. And we got pretty far. We got as far as the spinal cord. So let's move the spinal cord up. And I think this was a slide I was looking at. And maybe I'll zoom in to this slide right here. And the spinal cord goes from foramen magnum down to about the level of L2. It doesn't go all the way down to the sacrum. It stops right at the level of L2. And it's suspended in a fluid we call cerebrospinal fluid. There is a system of membranes around the brain and the spinal cord, which is one of the last things that we're going to look at in this chapter. We call that the meninges. And parts of these meninges has fluid in there. And that's called cerebrospinal fluid. Sometimes when somebody has an infection of the spinal cord or brain, right, we call that meningitis or encephalitis, and we need to take some of that fluid out and assay it for a fungal infection or for a bacterial infection. And so a needle then is just inserted into this intervertebral foramen right here. Hey, you guys, don't talk so much during lecture. Or talk softly or go outside in the hallway. Okay, so if a needle is inserted and some of the fluid is aspirated out, then of course you're going to be concerned about damaging the spinal cord. So a good place to do this is below the level of L2 because there's no spinal cord there. Right, right here is the conus medullaris. That's the tip of the spinal cord. So you can put a needle into this area here without worrying about damaging the spinal cord. And these nerves that you see coming down, which is what we call the cauda equina, typically move out of the way of that needle, right, so that they're not damaged. And so I mentioned that last time. The other thing that I mentioned last time was this phylum terminale. It's connective tissue that puts a little traction on the conus medullaris so that the spinal cord doesn't retract back up into the brain and damage all of these nerves that are coming out of the vertebral column. And I think I also did mention that every once in a while, during development, somebody's conus medullaris gets adhered to the sacrum or maybe even the coccyx. And as somebody grows, the bones grow a lot more rapidly than the nervous tissue does, than the spinal cord. All right, and then that stretches the spinal cord and destroys the spinal cord and produces a lot of neurological damage to that individual. Anybody remember what that's called? What did I call that last time? It's called a tethered cord. So when somebody has a tethered spinal cord to the sacrum or coccyx, then of course you want to have good prenatal care so that can be diagnosed early and then that tethered cord can be reduced so that the spinal cord can develop normally after that. Okay, the other thing we notice, you see all the different divisions, cervical, thoracic, and lumbar divisions, right? You're familiar with that. But the other thing that's probably new is that you might see two regions that are enlarged in the spinal cord, the cervical region and lumbar region, and it's exactly what we call it, the cervical enlargement and the lumbar enlargement. Why do you think these parts of the spinal cord are enlarged in these two areas? Because guess what you have corresponding to these two areas right here? You have the upper appendage, you have nerves going to and from the upper appendage within the cervical enlargement, and in the lumbar enlargement you have nerves, additional nerves going to your lower appendages. And all these appendages have special reflexes that take place within the spinal cord, so those areas require more neurons in order to protect your body, namely your appendages. All right, so you see that nicely on this figure. Okay, let's look at another figure of the spinal cord. Some nice dissections. What about curvature? I think I've talked about curvatures already. When we looked at the skeletal system, so I don't want to go over that again. But here is a nice transverse section. And I could quiz you really quick and say, what level of the spinal cord, or what level of the vertebral column is this transverse section drawn from? Cervical, right? Because of bifid spinous process. What's another clue? Ah, the transverse foramina, right. Okay, so that's a nice cervical vertebrae. And I can see a spinal nerve leaving the vertebral column, and it's a spinal nerve because it's leaving the spinal cord, right? So that's not too difficult to appreciate. Spinal nerve, brains, nerves that leave the brain. Nerves that leave the brain are what we call cranial nerves. Nerves that leave the cranium are cranial nerves. Nerves that leave the spinal cord are what we call spinal nerves. And so I see a nice spinal nerve right here. And there's only one nerve that enters through this intervertebral foramen. And then when it gets in near the spinal cord, I see it bifurcates into these two processes right here. And these are what we call roots. These are spinal roots. And these bring information either into the spinal cord or out of the spinal cord. So here is the spinous process of the cervical vertebrae. Is this posterior or anterior? It's posterior, right? The spinous process on a vertebrae is posterior. What's another name for a posterior? Dorsal. Yeah, this should just be on the tip of your tongue. So this root right here is actually called the dorsal root. And you could call it the posterior root, but nobody does. Right? Everybody should know what you're talking about. But here is the dorsal root. This nerve right here that's going to your body contains two sets of neurons. Neurons that take information to the periphery, and then another set of neurons that brings information into the central nervous system. Remember, a neuron can only transmit information in one direction. But a nerve, a peripheral nerve, carries information in both directions. Unlike these spinal roots, a root is only sensory or motor. It's never mixed. So if there's something that's mixed, it's carrying both afferent and efferent nerve signals. Okay, a root is always going to be one or the other. It's never mixed. This dorsal root right here is the sensory root. All right, what's another name for sensory? Afferent, right? So the dorsal root is afferent. It brings signals into the spinal cord. And then this ventral root right here, or this anterior root, is the motor root. So if there's damage to this root right here, where I have the cursor, which is the ventral root, and if it gets damaged, all right, what's the deficit that a person is going to have? Is it going to be a sensory deficit or a motor deficit? Will they not be able to perceive some part of their body, or won't they be able to control it? Since this is the motor root, a motor takes signals from the CNS to the periphery, right? So if there's damage in this one, then a person will have a motor deficit. They won't be able to control some part of the body. But if there's damage to the dorsal root, then they'll have some kind of paresthesia or inappropriate sensation on some part of their body, but perfect motor function. Right? Furthermore, if there's damage to a spinal nerve, like in this location right here, what could the deficit be? It could be sensory, or it could be motor, or it could be both, because the spinal nerve is mixed, but a root is either afferent or efferent. It's never mixed. Okay. Something else that I see right here is a bulge in the dorsal root, and this is in the peripheral nervous system. It's outside the spinal cord, so this is what we call a ganglion. This is a dorsal root ganglion. This contains the nerve cell bodies of all those pseudo-unipolar or unipolar neurons. And remember what the function of a unipolar neuron was? It is for sensation. It's an afferent nerve classification by structure, and all the nerve cell bodies are located here. So the peripheral process of a unipolar nerve comes out over here, and the central process goes into the spinal cord. Okay, the other thing I notice on the spinal cord right here is the gray matter is deep, unlike the brain. Gray matter is superficial. It's on the cortex of the brain. White matter in the spinal cord is superficial. And who can tell me something about white matter versus gray matter when you see it right here? What would you like to describe first? How about gray matter? What makes up gray matter? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, non-myelinated parts of neurons. Right? And white matter is made up of? Okay, yeah, they're tracts, which means that they're axons, the axonal part of a neuron. And since it's white, it means that they're myelinated. So they're myelinated axons. So these are big cables that are moving up the spinal cord or down the spinal cord. If they're starting at this level here and going up to the brain, then that is an afferent tract. If it's starting in the brain and going inferiorly, then that is, or descending tract, then that is a motor tract. All right, so tracts that ascend to the brain are afferent or sensory. Tracts that descend through the spinal cord are motor tracts or efferent tracts, and they're going to be in different locations, which kind of follows the architecture of the brain. Where is the primary motor cortex in the brain that controls your skeletal muscles for you? That is the, that's the frontal lobe, and in particular, that's what I was really getting at. It's the frontal lobe, and in particular, the precentral gyrus, which is in the frontal lobe. Most of the motor tracts in the spinal cord are anterior. Just like all of the sensory parts of the brain are posterior, like the parietal lobe, occipital lobe, most of the tracts that are sensory are in the dorsal part of the spinal cord. Okay, it's not absolutely true, but it kind of follows the architecture of the brain. So that's another reason to know something about the brain. All right, these spaces right here are filled with cerebral spinal fluid. We're going to talk about those, the cerebral spinal fluid in just a little bit. All right, so don't forget, dorsal root is 100% sensory, and the ventral root is 100% motor, and you should know the synonyms for sensory and motor in the nervous system. What's a synonym for sensory? Afferent, right? And the synonym for motor is efferent. Okay. Okay, let me find another slide. So here is a nice exam figure. It shows the membrane system, the connective tissue system around the spinal cord, which is, of course, central nervous system. And it labels the gray matter and white matter. So the gray matter right here has little projections coming off of it that we call horns. So here is the dorsal horn, here's the lateral horn, and here is the ventral horn. Oh, it's kind of labeled a little bit funny. You have to watch these lead lines. But dorsal, all right, and ventral, and then the one poking out to the side, of course, is the lateral horn. We see this in the thoracic region of the spinal cord, this lateral horn right here. There is a tube going through the very center of the spinal cord. We call it the central canal, and it too contains cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, and this gray matter has nerve cell bodies and dendrites. The white matter right here contains tracts, and these tracts sometimes are called columns, or sometimes they're called a funiculus. So here's the dorsal funiculus, here's the lateral funiculus, and then here's the ventral funiculus. And remember, the ventral funiculus is mostly for sensory tracts, and the dorsal funiculus is mostly for motor tracts. Okay, but not necessarily true. All right, so here is the ventral root. Here's the dorsal root. What can you tell me about the function of this dorsal root right here? It's sensory, 100% sensory. What about the function of this ventral root? 100% motor. They join together to make a spinal nerve right here. So what's the function of a spinal nerve? Since it's a combination of a dorsal root and a ventral root, it is simply what we call mixed. You could say afferent and efferent, but another easy way of saying it is that a spinal nerve is always mixed. And here's that dorsal root ganglion. So on this slide, we see the different funiculi, we see the different horns of the gray matter, the central canal. There's also some white matter right here that's going from the right to the left side of the spinal cord. And what kind of tract did we say carries information from the right side of the central nervous system to the left side? It's a real funny word. It starts with a C. And as a matter of fact, the part of the brain that the major carrier of information from right to left starts with a C too. It's called the corpus callosum. But that doesn't that describes the structure inside the brain, but not the function of those fibers. How do we designate fibers that go from right to left parts of the central nervous system? We call those commissural fibers. Again, it starts with a C. So here is the gray commissure right here, right, which is carrying information from right to left, right around the central canal. All right, so I think that's pretty good for spinal cord. Oh, here's a depression, right, in the ventral surface. So this is the ventral median fissure. And then here's another depression right here that separates right from left. And this is the dorsal median sulcus. It's kind of funny to me because the sulcus looks deeper than the fissure. And typically in anatomy, a fissure is something that's bigger than a sulcus. All right, it just so happens that's how it got named. So those are all the things that you should be able to label on this particular diagram. All right, I do want to talk about the meninges sometime. I want to talk about a couple of tracts within the spinal cord. Where do you find tracts? In the white matter or gray matter of the spinal cord? white matter, because they're myelinated axons carrying information very rapidly over long distances. All right, so let me show you a couple. That's just a demonstration of spinal tap. Will I find the correct slide? I'll just leave it here. So it's got to be below the level of L2 so that the spinal cord is not damaged. And where do I want to find some tracts? Here's some good tracts. Okay, these are not all good exam figures, but some of them are. And I want you to know some of these for just the purpose of nomenclature. Okay, and probably not this one. What are the two that I want you to know? Spinal thalamic and cortical spinal. Okay, here is the spinal thalamic tract. All right, and just like in muscles, the first part of the word designates the origin, and the second part of the word designates what its destination is. So spinal thalamic tract is a sensory tract because it's a tract that starts in the spinal cord and it goes to the thalamus. And I showed you the thalamus last time. That's deep inside the brain. So this gray area right here is the thalamus. It's gray matter because it's nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And the spinal thalamic tract is bringing information from the periphery, for instance, like pain receptors in the foot or hand. It enters the spinal cord through the dorsal root because, and then I see a nice unipolar neuron right here, enters the dorsal root, synapses on a second neuron. So the sensory neuron is like a first order neuron. The second order neuron goes from the spinal cord. Here's the nerve cell body and the gray matter of the dorsal horn. It crosses over, and when something crosses over in neuroanatomy, we say it decussates over. So there's a decussation of this nerve fiber, joins the spinal thalamic tract, and then arises all the way up to the thalamus. That's the second neuron. And remember, we said that the function of the thalamus, it was a relay center, relay station. It's going to take information from the spinal thalamic tract and then designate it where to go within the cerebral cortex with the third order neuron. And remember, the auditory cortex was in the temporal lobe, visual cortex is in the occipital lobe, and all the different sensations on your body right here are in the parietal lobe. And so it's the job of the thalamus to direct those nerve impulses to the proper part of the brain for your proper perception of what those different modalities and different locations are. Okay, so this is the spinal thalamic tract, and you know because I only give you one tract that is a sensory tract, and you know this is a sensory tract because look at these arrows right here. Which way do they go? They're going from a lower division to a higher division within the spinal cord and eventually reaching the brain. So that's got to be a sensory pathway. So spinal thalamic is a sensory pathway. So then it probably makes sense for you to know another kind of pathway. Since that was a sensory pathway, I just chose one motor pathway. Okay, so here we see a nice cross-section, actually not a cross-section, but a coronal section of the brain, and I can see the gray matter, and inside the gray matter of the brain, I'm going to really zoom into this region right here now. Right, and if we look in the gray matter, what do we know about gray matter? What does it contain? What parts of a neuron? Dendrites and nerve cell body. And see this little circle right here? That's signifying the nerve cell body of this motor neuron, and motor neurons are just multipolar neurons, they're not unipolar like sensory neurons. So we see that in the gray matter. And then it sends an axon out, okay, which is myelinated, so that makes what kind of matter? A myelinated axon makes in this area right here? White matter, and indeed that's white matter within the brain. It's a myelinated tract. And then it moves between the thalamus, which you might remember, the thalamus right here, and some basal nuclei, because a nucleus deep inside the brain is gray matter. So this right here is what we call the internal capsule. The internal capsule is white matter deep inside the brain specifically for what kind of tract, a sensory tract or a motor tract? Because the signal originates in the brain, goes down into the spinal cord, this is a motor tract. So the internal capsule is specifically for efferent fibers, myelinated efferent fibers. Let's see if I can use the thumb wheel. Oh, I can. Okay. So then this motor fiber moves through the midbrain, including the cerebral peduncle right here, through the pons, and then through the medulla, okay, and it finally ends up in the spinal cord. So this is what we call the cortical spinal tract, because the origin is the cortex, the destination is the spinal cord, and you see these arrows are pointing down, meaning that it's an efferent pathway, an efferent tract, and you can see where it goes. And what it's going to innervate is skeletal muscle. And here is the effector organ for skeletal muscle that just signifies some kind of skeletal muscle. So that's an example of the corticospinal tract. So just for nomenclature purposes, you should know. So one neuron is required to go from the cerebral cortex all the way down to the level of the spinal cord where it's going to exit. And then there's a somatic motor neuron, sometimes we call this a lower motor neuron, which is the second neuron, which then goes all the way from the spinal cord. Let me really zoom into this region. Okay, it goes from the spinal cord all the way to the effector organ. And here I can see the nerve cell bodies of this nice multipolar neuron leaving the spinal cord. And if it's a motor neuron, what route does it have to take? Not what route, but what route does it have to take? I see two routes. I see a dorsal route, and I see a ventral route. So it's got to be a ventral route, and indeed, the ventral route is what? 100% motor or efferent. And that's exactly how this motor neuron leaves, and then it joins the spinal nerve to go to this particular effector organ someplace. And here's the dorsal route. And what's this bulge on the dorsal route called? Yeah, that's the dorsal root ganglia, which contains the nerve cell bodies of those unipolar neurons that are sensory neurons bringing information in to the dorsal root and then the spinal cord. All right, so those are two of the tracts. And I want to look at some reflexes. Maybe I'm going to have to come back to reflex. I might not have a picture loaded up. I might have to, I'm going to have to come back to reflex at another time. Okay, but here is a nice diagram that shows commissural fibers going through the corpus callosum. Okay, then we see efferent fibers going through the internal capsule. All right, so these are motor fibers. These are what we call projection fibers. And then we also see fibers that don't go from one side of the brain to the other, don't ascend or descend through the brain, but go from one gyrus to another. These are what we call association tracts or association fibers. All right, so those are the three kinds of fibers, and we've talked about them already. Association, commissural, and projection, depending on which way they're going. All right, your anatomy textbook has these nuclei labeled as basal ganglia. And there are very few anatomy textbooks that do that anymore these days, because gray matter deep inside the central nervous system now technically and properly is called a what? It's called a nucleus. So in modern textbooks, we're going to call these the basal nuclei, but an older designation was calling these basal ganglia. So basal ganglia is still used quite a bit by everybody, right? But a basal ganglia and a basal nucleus is the same. It's just a group of nerve cell bodies. And these are mostly used for controlling somatic motor functions, like skeletal muscle functions. These are the things that become damaged, for instance, in Parkinson's disease, when somebody has a motor deficit. Okay. That's just for your own information. All right, let's talk about the meninges around the brain. This is the membrane system. And the brain doesn't, you'll notice, doesn't have any bones when we start to do a dissection. There are no bones that are holding the brain together, and the brain is fairly delicate tissue. And so what's protecting the brain are the chambers, and I can see it maybe right here, a lateral ventricle. Here's another one. Sort of looks blue to me. Is this sort of blue color too? Sure, because it contains a fluid called cerebral spinal fluid. Cerebral spinal fluid is also found around the outside of the brain, contained within the meninges or the membrane system, and that helps suspend the brain, that floats the brain so it's not quite so heavy. It also has a tendency to distribute shock to the brain that preserves the nervous tissue of the brain from trauma. just like if you were to look at a football helmet today compared to maybe 20 years ago, you'll see that a football helmet on the inside has a number of different chambers in it filled with fluid and air, which is a way to absorb shock or trauma to a football player's brain so they don't experience quite so much trauma when they get hit in the head with another helmet, for instance, or somebody's knee, right? Which is part of the job of the meninges. All right, so let's look at the meninges. It's got three main layers that make up the meninges. Here's a good exam figure. So here is just a nice coronal section through the brain. Here I can see cortical gray matter, nerve cell bodies and dendrites on the surface of the brain. Here's white matter that's a little bit deeper within the cerebrum. And then here's the skin of the scalp. And here is a bone of the skull. So this could be maybe the parietal bone, for instance. And there's a membrane on the outside of the parietal bone, just like there is on every bone, that's called what, the periosteum. And there's a membrane on the inside of the bone, and we call that the endosteum. But in the brain, okay, we still call that endosteum is inside. All right, so here is the outside of the bone, and that's still the periosteum. But it pairs up with another membrane that we call the meningeal division of the dura mater. So the dura mater has actually two membranes. It's got the periosteal division and the meningeal division, and it's a very tough membrane. You're going to see that it's really hard to cut through without damaging the brain underneath it. And hence, that's how it got its name. That's the durable membrane, or the dura mater. The most superficial one is the strongest one. All right, then there's another one called the arachnoid membrane. I can see it right through here. It's a lot thinner, a lot more delicate than the dura mater. And then there's even a third one. The third one is the deepest one, and it lies right on the surface of the brain and follows every gyrus and every sulcus. All right, so here's a deep invagination of the pia mater. The pia mater is a very delicate membrane. You might not even notice it on your dissections. And there are some connective tissue fibers that connect the pia mater with the arachnoid matter right here, or the arachnoid membrane. So since this is the arachnoid membrane, and I see a pretty big space with these fibers in it, this space is also filled with cerebrospinal fluid. So this is another location for cerebrospinal fluid on the outside of the central nervous system. And the meninges continues on all the way down the spinal cord and not just the brain. So between the arachnoid and pia, even in the spinal cord, you're going to find this subarachnoid space filled with cerebrospinal fluid. Right? And it's called the subarachnoid space because here is the arachnoid membrane. Sub meaning below, that's filled with cerebrospinal fluid. In between the arachnoid and the pia mater is cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid is made in some of the ventricles or chambers in the brain. And those things are called the choroid plexus. I'll show you where those are. And since they're always producing cerebrospinal fluid, that would actually compress our brain. That would squeeze our brain down. So the cerebrospinal fluid, as it's being produced, is also being resorbed and put back into the circulatory system. So it's a nice fluid flow of system so the brain doesn't swell up. Cerebrospinal fluid goes back to the circulatory system via these little granulations that we call an arachnoid villus. And it just pokes up through the dura mater into this sinus. This is a superior sagittal sinus, and it just contains blood. It drains blood from the brain as well as cerebrospinal fluid and completes the circulatory system of the brain. And you know that's right in the, sagittal sinus of the brain, which is what, right here on midline. Okay. Separating the hemispheres is the dura mater, as well as the other two divisions of the meninges. But this part of the dura mater is what we call the falx cerebri, and it's located only in the longitudinal fissure, which separates the right and left hemispheres. So this kind of also illustrates that the right and left hemispheres can't communicate with each other through this space because of the dura mater. Signals have to descend to the level of the corpus callosum and then hop on a commissural track to go from right to left and then reascend on the other side of the brain for the right and left hemispheres to share information. So here is a really good exam figure that you should know in terms of I guess all the blood vessels, how cerebrospinal fluid is returned to the circulatory system, but also all the layers of the meninges. Okay, so the dermator is the toughest layer. The one in the middle is the arachnoid. It's not quite as tough as the dermator. Right below the arachnoid is the subarachnoid space filled with cerebrospinal fluid that comes from the ventricles of the brain. And then the tightly bound layer that's very, very delicate right on the surface of the brain is called the pia mater. Okay, we talked about the falx cerebri. There's also a separation between the cerebrum and the cerebellum. Let's see where it might be located. Ah, this is a good picture right here. All right, so here's the falx cerebri right in the longitudinal fissure. And this area right here is about where the cerebellum is going to be. And on this dissection, we can see the cerebellum. Here's the cerebral hemisphere, and in particular, the occipital lobe of the cerebral hemisphere. So here's the occipital lobe. And there is the dermator separating the cerebellum from the occipital lobe, and we call that the falx. The tentorium, right here, tentorium. The falx cerebelli is the separation between the hemispheres of the cerebellum, kind of analogous to the falx cerebri, which is the dermator between the hemispheres of the cerebrum. The other nice thing that this shows is blood returning to the body from the brain via the superior sagittal sinus, okay? Then into this blood vessel, then finally into the jugular, and then the jugular is going to return to the heart. We're going to take a look at that in a little bit more detail when we get into the cardiovascular system. All right, so those, and you can see the dermator is really sturdy, really, really tough kind of membrane. All right, another figure that I want you to know, I'll get to that one, is this. Okay, I don't know if this is an exam figure or not. Before I get to this one, I want to show you the chambers inside the brain, the ventricles. And where are the ventricles? Okay, so these blue areas deep inside the brain, we can see it from a anterior view and a lateral view. These things are filled with cerebrospinal fluid, which is fairly similar to blood plasma. All right, but blood plasma does not contain white blood cells or red blood cells, and cerebrospinal fluid shouldn't have red blood cells or white blood cells either. If it does, that means that there is an infection in the brain. So these chambers that are lateral, they're off of midline, we call these the lateral ventricles. They used to be called the first and second ventricle, but no longer. We just call these the lateral ventricles, and they kind of curve around. They curve around posteriorly, and then move up superiorly, and then move anteriorly again. So here is a lateral ventricle from the side view. Okay, I'm not going to ask you to know the different horns, like the posterior horn or anterior horn. I just want you to know this is a lateral ventricle because they're in the lateral parts of the cerebral hemispheres. And there is a structure in the lateral ventricles that we call a choroid plexus. And I saw a choroid plexus. Oh, where did I see that choroid plexus at? Rats. The choroid plexus. Right here. Okay. Here's a nice microscopic view of a choroid plexus. Here is a blood vessel. It's a capillary. So it's sort of a leaky blood vessel. It allows fluid to leak out. And then here are the neuroglia cells that form right on the surface of this capillary. And these are what we call ependymal cells. When we put a capillary together with these ependymal cells, it makes part of the choroid plexus, which then takes fluid from the blood and puts it into a ventricle. And that fluid is what? Cerebrospinal fluid. These cells make sure that it's high in glucose because that's the substrate that our brain needs to make ATP. It's high in oxygen, vitamins, irons, and also these electrolytes, sodium, chloride, and magnesium. It actually puts that into the ventricles, the lateral ventricles, the third ventricle, and even the fourth ventricle. All right, so let's go back to that flow pattern. Okay, so here is, oh no, I was showing you the ventricles first. Okay, so lateral ventricles. Here is the third ventricle, right at the level of the thalamus, and it's a pretty thin ventricle. And there's a connecting tube between the third ventricle and the lateral ventricles, and we call that the interventricular foramen. And remember, what's the function of a foramen? It's a passageway, and in this particular case, it's a passageway not for nerve or for blood, but for cerebral spinal fluid that's originating in the lateral ventricles, which then flows into the third ventricle. I can see the third ventricle right here. There's a choroid plexus in the roof of the third ventricle that even makes more cerebral spinal fluid, and it doesn't flow into the lateral, but it flows inferiorly through this little connecting duct right here that we call the aqueduct of Sylvius, or sometimes the cerebral aqueduct, into the next biggest chamber, which is the fourth ventricle. So you got lateral ventricle, third ventricle, fourth ventricle, and there's a nice flow pattern of cerebral spinal fluid, just in that order. And there's another choroid plexus in the fourth ventricle that's making cerebral spinal fluid. And from there, cerebral spinal fluid can flow through the central canal of the spinal cord all the way down to the conus medullaris, where it leaves the spinal cord, enters the subarachnoid space, or it can leave at the level of the fourth ventricle through some apertures into the subarachnoid space. So these are what we call the lateral apertures. And remember, then cerebral spinal fluid will flow back up to the superior parts of the brain, and then through an arachnoid granulation gets resorbed back into the circulatory system. All right, so for lab, I'm not sure if it's next time or the time after, you will want to know these ventricles. And I'm sure this is an exam figure here too as well. So lateral ventricle, third ventricle, fourth ventricle, the intraventricular foramen, and the cerebral aqueduct. You become familiar with these when we start playing around with them in lab. Okay, now let's look at that flow pattern. The flow pattern is right here. So here is a lateral ventricle. Here's the third ventricle around the thalamus. Here's the cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle, which is between the pons and the cerebellum. And then that flow can leave through an aperture into the subarachnoid space or flow down through the central canal of the spinal cord all the way down to the conus medullaris, then it will exit the spinal cord and then flow back up to the brain to be resorbed by these arachnoid granulations or arachnoid villi. Right. And this space filled with cerebral spinal fluid right here is the subarachnoid space. It's just a space right underneath the arachnoid membrane. Can anybody, and so here I see a choroid plexus, here I see a choroid plexus in the lateral ventricle, in a third ventricle, and in the fourth ventricle. These are the tissues that make cerebral spinal fluid. I forgot what I was going to ask you. Did I ask you? Who is reading my mind? Remind me what I was thinking. I forget. Oh well. Okay. Might come back to me, might not. All right, so since there has to be a flow pattern here, this changes with respiratory rate, it changes with heart rate. So for instance, when your heart beats, it's actually a very violent kind of muscle contraction, and it forces a lot of blood up into, from the heart up into the brain. And can the brain expand and contract as blood is being pumped up into it? Because what's holding it? The cranium, right? Which does not change size. So the cranium has a fixed size, so if we shove a bunch of blood into your brain, something's got to move. And what moves is cerebral spinal fluid out of the brain. Okay, so there's a nice pulsatile flow of cerebral spinal fluid that moves through the interventricular foramen and down through this cerebral aqueduct. And if for whatever reason, if there's a tumor or some kind of malformation of these ducts, then this fluid can't flow, and then these chambers start to enlarge and get big and blow up, right? And then that compresses the brain tissue. We call that hydrocephalus. And here's an example of hydrocephalus. Okay, and I don't know how long this individual would live, probably not a very long time because of the severe neuronal deficits, but the nice thing today is because of ultrasound and good prenatal care, these conditions can be diagnosed very easily in utero, And they can be surgically corrected in utero before the fetus develops and, before the fetus is born. And that prevents this neurological damage from happening. So that's pretty amazing, right, that they can do surgery in utero, which means what, before birth, before parturition, to reduce, okay, some of these hydrocephalus or enlarged ventricular chambers in the brain. Okay, so that's it for central nervous system. I'm going to go back, maybe talk about reflexes, maybe in the next chapter. And I think I talked about them. You know, I think we talked about reflexes even in the introductory chapter. So this is probably just even a review. But you should know that a reflex always starts with a stimulus, ends in a response. And what do you have to have in order to sense a stimulus? You need a receptor. And in order to produce a response, you need an effector organ. And an effector organ for voluntary would be a skeletal muscle, but for involuntary control would be cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or a gland would be the effectors for autonomic control. Okay, who's got a question on any of this stuff so far? Well, I'm really glad we're having a lab next time, because it's hard to appreciate all this brain stuff just by looking at pictures. So we'll be working with some models next time. All right, so we're going to move on to the next chapter. Which is, what chapter is that? Chapter 14. Okay, so you see some familiar slides right here. Like, here's a picture of the integument. And when we studied the integument, we learned about some sensory receptors for pain, which are free nerve endings. Temperature, cold, and hot are free nerve endings. And then some for vibration. Deep vibration would be a Pacinian corpuscle. And then for very light touch, for instance, would be a Meissner's corpuscle right here in different parts of the nervous system. So we should also break the peripheral nervous system down into two functional organizations, and that is sensory versus motor. All right, so the peripheral nervous system, if it's sensory, takes information from the periphery, like for instance the skin right here, to the central nervous system, to the spinal cord, and then to the brain. And there's a somatic division that goes to the skin and body wall and limbs, and there's a visceral division that goes into body cavities. And the kinds of sensations are drastically different. I don't know if anybody's had a kidney stone, or has given birth, okay, or had an appendicitis. That kind of pain is a lot different compared to pain that we feel on the surface, or somatic pain. Somatic pain is a very acute, sharp pain, okay, that is intense. Visceral pain is a very dull pain. And it's very hard to describe where it's taking place in your body, but it still has the same intensity. It just has some different attributes about it. Okay, motor, again, there's a somatic division. This goes to voluntary skeletal muscle, which is not in body cavities. And then there is a visceral or autonomic division, which goes to the effector organs that are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. And that is smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. All right, so the somatic nervous system only has one effector organ, but the autonomic nervous system has three effector organs, and everything is controlled in your body that way. Okay, structural organization. There are peripheral sensory receptors. There are also central receptors inside the brain. And there are peripheral motor endings for controlling skeletal muscle, like the neuromuscular junction that we talked about. And the nerves leave the central nervous system either through the brain or the spinal cord. If they leave the brain, we call them cranial nerves. And there are 12 pairs of them. I think that's an important number for you to know. 12 pairs. And we're going to learn the names of those nerves. or a nerve could leave the spinal cord, and there are 31 pairs of those nerves as well. And we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at those spinal nerves. I just want you to know what a root is that we covered in the previous chapter. The dorsal root, ventral root goes to making up a spinal nerve. But we're going to spend some time looking at these cranial nerves. Okay, we talked about some of these nerve endings already, but another way that we can classify nerve endings is depending on where they are sensing information. They're called exteroreceptors if they're near the body surface and they're monitoring our environment. So they monitor things outside our body, like room temperature, pressure, pain. Okay, and most special sense organs, like for vision and taste, they're monitoring the external environment, not the internal environment. But we do have receptors inside our body to measure various kinds of chemicals and states inside our body, and those are what we call interoceptors for visceral pain, for instance, maybe when you're having appendicitis or nausea, hunger, or the sensation of fullness. All right, these are due to interoceptors, and there are also blood pressure receptors inside our body. And temperature receptors inside our body, those would be interoceptors. Anything that's monitoring the internal environment is an interoceptor. Right? And then the third kind right here is called a proprioceptor. Proprioceptors are what we find in all skeletal muscles and joints and tendons, and they tell our brain what position our body is in and what kind of tension a muscle is producing. So even with your eyes closed, if I were to walk over to you and grab your arm and take your hand and put it above your head, even with your eyes closed, you could tell where your hand was because of all those proprioceptors all over the body. Right? All muscles have them, joints have them, and tendons have them, and ligaments have them. All right. We can also classify receptors by the type of stimulus. Like there are mechanoreceptors for monitoring mechanical kinds of stimuli like touch or pressure or vibration. There are thermoreceptors for monitoring what kind of sensation? Temperature. Yeah, so it would be like a thermometer. Chemoreceptors for measuring different kinds of chemicals in your body like salts and also glucose. There are glucose receptors. Right? And then a photoreceptor is important for receiving or sensing light. Right, and we have photoreceptors in our retinas, in our eyes. And a nociceptor is any kind of receptor that can monitor some kind of painful stimulus, whether it's a painful chemical stimulus or mechanical stimulus or temperature stimulus. Right, we can also classify these receptors by their shape. They can be encapsulated or non-encapsulated. And even these proprioceptors, like a Meissner's corpuscle is encapsulated, Pacinian corpuscle, these things kind of look like onions, maybe you can recall, and a Ruffini's corpuscle, these are encapsulated. Non-encapsulated would be like the free nerve endings for temperature and pain. And hair follicle receptors, just free nerve endings on hair follicles. So when a hair shaft is disturbed, these free nerve endings right here, then are stimulated so that you have the sensation of something on the surface of your skin. Proprioceptors in muscles, we call it a spindle apparatus for monitoring stretch. And Golgi tendon organs for monitoring tendon stretch. And then there are also what we call kinesthetic receptors within joint capsules. Right, so every joint capsule, fibrous capsule, has these receptors to protect the integrity of a joint so that you don't overdo stretching or motion at a particular joint. And they can actually cause pain. All right, let's look at these cranial nerves. And we said there are 12 pairs of cranial nerves. And they can be categorized into one of four different kinds of nerves that leave the brain. We're going to look and see where they are. The first kind would be a sensory nerve. And the sensory nerve, it would be just 100% sensory. And the 100% sensory nerves are number 1, number 2, and number 8 of the 12. Right? And that's for vision, touch, and pain. These three nerves right here are the only three cranial nerves that are 100% sensory. Other cranial nerves are 100% motor. That means they take signals out of the brain to the periphery, to skeletal muscles in the head and neck. And those are cranial nerves 3, 4, 6, 11, and 12. So those are motor nerves. Some are involved with the parasympathetic nervous system, and we can't talk about that today, but we're going to talk about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system next week. And parasympathetic motor will lead through cranial nerves 3, 7, 9, and probably the most important one here is cranial nerve number 10. All these cranial nerves have names, which we're going to go over in just a little bit, and you're going to know cranial nerve number 10 as the vagus nerve. Cranial nerve 10, and that's a very important parasympathetic motor neuron, which means that can take parasympathetic stimulation and carry it to various effector organs in the body, including glands, smooth muscle, and your heart. So cranial nerve number 10 is important in regulating your heart. All right, so how are we going to make this a little bit easier job? We're going to use a mnemonic. We haven't really used a mnemonic very much in this class. Right, but a mnemonic is using a phrase in English, or you could use some other language. And so you just memorize an order of words, and the first letter of each of those words corresponds to the first letter of a cranial nerve, or something that's unfamiliar to you. Because you're probably not familiar at all with names of cranial nerves. And so you want to know cranial nerve number 1, its name, and cranial nerve number 2, okay, all the way through 12. This mnemonic will help you. Here's a website that contains hundreds or thousands of medical mnemonics that you could learn. For instance, if you wanted to know the action origin and innervation of a muscle, or where nerves go in the body, or where blood vessels go in the body, this is a handy website. Okay, but there's also a mnemonic in here, or a number of them, for the cranial nerves. Okay, and you can put different filters on. You can get X-rated mnemonics or just regular PG-rated mnemonics. And I only want to hear the PG-rated ones, not the X-rated ones, right? But if you need to write down an X-rated one on a test or something, I suppose you can do that. I won't take off for it. All right, so here is a mnemonic, and you're going to see that it has 12 words. And these 12 words correspond to the names of the 12 cranial nerves, or nerves that leave the cranium. And here's the same. Your book has another one, and maybe you have your own. Maybe you even want to make up your own. So here's a mnemonic that says, on old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. Right, which makes perfect sense to me. I don't know if it does to you, but so a Finn is just somebody from Finland, right? And a German is just somebody from Germany, right? So that's pretty easy. And they're looking out over a valley that's filled with a grain that we call a hop. And does anybody know what you can make a hop with?
Beer,
yeah. And so I guess Finns and Germans are famous for brewing, you know, fancy kinds of beers, or they'd like to drink beer, hard to imagine any more than anybody else in the world. And Olympus happens to be the name of a mountain in Europe. So you're not familiar with it, but it's a very famous mountain. So here these guys are sitting on old Olympus's towering top that just refers to this mountain, and they're looking over these fields of grain, which is made of a hop. So the first letter of each of these words right here corresponds to the first letter of the cranial nerve. Cranial nerve number 1 signified by on, so the first letter of cranial nerve number 1 is an O. And that just so happens refers to the sense of smell or the olfactory nerve. And I think we looked at this when we were looking at the ethmoid bone. Right? I said, what's the most anterior sense organ on your head? That is your nose. That sense is olfaction. That's cranial nerve number 1. What's the next most anterior sense on your face? Is your eyes, yeah. And that's cranial nerve number 2. And that's what this little O in old stands for. Right? That's the optic nerve. And remember the 1 and 2 right here, these are purely sensory nerves. Right? So on refers to olfactory, old refers to optic. The next one, oculomotor, for pupil constriction. Okay, so this is not sensory, this is a motor nerve, that's cranial nerve number 3, and on down the line, trochlear, trigeminal, abducens, goes to an eye muscle. And guess what the function of the abducens is? It contracts a muscle that abducts the eye, makes your eye look toward the center, right? So that, that would be an adductor. Abducens makes you look laterally, so you can look right or you can look left. Okay, that's cranial nerve number 7. And here's that cranial nerve number 10 again, the vagus nerve. It's an important parasympathetic nerve, and it's used to decrease heart rate. So here is just a little cheat sheet for you. All right, so your book has many functions of these nerves, but I would only test you on these that are in your lecture notes. All right, so, or maybe even on a practicum. So if it's on a practicum, remember, only one correct answer is necessary. And on the lecture test, I could ask you, what is the function of cranial nerve number 2? And you're going to say vision. So maybe just kind of look at your face, think of how, what we talked about before. Cranial nerve number 1 is for the sense of olfaction or smell. Okay, maybe I'll go over that. We'll go over that again soon sometime. But here's another mnemonic. Okay, because these nerves, these 12 cranial nerves right here, may be purely sensory, maybe purely motor, or they might have components of both afferent and efferent fibers in them. And if that's the case, right, we're going to call them mixed nerves or both. So here's a mnemonic. If the word starts with an S, then it's a sensory nerve. If the word starts with an M, that means it's 100% motor. And if it's a B, then it's going to contain both afferent and efferent information. So here's a little handy saying that you could write out on a piece of paper I'll give you during the test. And it says, some say, and there's 12 words for each of the 12 cranial nerves. Some say money matters. So cranial nerve number 1 is what? Sensory. Cranial nerve number 2 is sensory. Cranial nerve number 3 starts with an M, so that's a motor nerve, right? Okay, and then you could use another mnemonic to find out what cranial nerve number 3 was, right? So that's oculomotor. So motor and motor kind of match up really nice. And then the rest of the mnemonic says, but my brother says big something matters most. Okay, and you could put like big brains or big bucks matter most, right? So just to help you remember some of these things. So you don't have to brute force memorize which nerve is sensory, which one is motor, and which one is mixed. You can help, you can get a little aid with that by using the mnemonics. All right, so let's see if we can find some cranial nerves. Here's an exam figure. So we're looking at the ventral side of the brain, and I can see the frontal lobe, I can see the temporal lobe right here, the pons, the cerebellum, and the medulla is in this region. And these gold structures are the cranial nerves from anterior to posterior. And the cranial nerves are just numbered as they move from anterior to posterior. And the most anterior is cranial nerve number 1, which is the olfactory. The one behind it is the optic, cranial nerve number 2. And then number 3, number 4, right, number 5. So understanding the numbers of cranial nerves on this diagram is really easy because it just goes from 1 to 12 from anterior to posterior with maybe just a little jogging around in this region right here. So this exam figure is pretty easy. All right, and then you can use a mnemonic to know, like on Olympus's towering top, to know what the name of that cranial nerve is, right, to help you match up this diagram on the lecture test. Okay, the nice thing that I see on this particular diagram, remember the divisions of the brain? We have the brain stem, which is the medulla, and the pons. Here I can see the columns that I promised I would show you. All right, so here are some columns within the medulla, which contain tracts, and these are descending tracts, and sometimes information crosses over between these tracts or between these columns, and so forms little triangular structures that kind of look like pyramids. And so sometimes these little tracks right here we actually call pyramids on the surface of the medulla. And since fibers are crossing over, we say that these nerve fibers decussate at the level of the pyramids within the medulla, or decussation of the pyramids happens right here on the medulla, right on this region here. All right, so this is not a terribly difficult exam figure to look at. It's not too bad. All right, and I think next time we're going to start looking at spinal nerves, as opposed to what kind of nerves do we have over here on the brain? These are what we call cranial nerves, right? These are cranial nerves. Spinal nerves will originate from the spinal cord instead.